and welcome to Worstwood Forward, where we celebrate the best of the worst. I'm Barry McStay, and each week I, my co-host, and our guest propose our candidates for the title of the world's worst something. This week we are making devotions at the shrine of the holy worst foot. After all, there is something quite stigmatic about our logo, if you look closely enough. We have made our way here barefoot the entire way, though in fairness we did drive. It was a heartfelt effort to save our souls. We are self-flagellating on the hour, every hour, with the most vicious of wooden lashes. My co-host has a birch rod, while mine is a walnut whip. We are uttering... We are uttering prayers of penance, though due to a typo, we misread the requirement for penance and spent several hours rehearsing our version of I Am the Very Model of a Modern Major General. And of course, we have brought with us the required gifts. The serving suggestion was the blood of virgins, but thankfully, we had that to hand as we both had the foresight to take a syringe to ourselves in our early 20s. And alongside me is the tail to my Canterbury, the father to my pilgrim, and the crusader knight to my genocidal maniac. It's Ben Vandervelde.
Oh, blessings be upon you, pilgrim. Have you ever done any pilgrim
ages? I have done pilgrim ages. I went to Taizé, which is a pilgrim location in sort of south central France.
Egypt, I was going to say south central LA.
Well, you know, Jesus was born in a crib. Taizé's like, you go, it's a lot of young people go there, and there's a massive like mega church thing, and you go and sing really nice Taizé chants. They're sort of very repetitive, very soothing, beautiful chants, and then you do like work, like doing the washing up or cooking food. It's quite like a little commune-y thing.
You've made that sound a lot nicer and a lot less culty than I believed, because I was about to say the Jews don't really have pilgrimages, but I guess, but then going to visit the Western Wall in Jerusalem, yeah, kind of counts as one.
Yeah.
It's just not nearly as important or totemic.
Yeah, did you, because you did Jew camp when you were younger, didn't you?
I did, well, and a big thing is when you're 16, you go and travel around Israel for 3.5 weeks.
You did that as well?
Yes, getting various levels of indoctrination and propaganda in amongst the trying desperately to get your end away and buy some fourth-rate Israeli marijuana. One thing I remember of going to the Western Wall was you go there on Saturday, on Friday night for Friday night prayers, and it's quite a thing to all be walking towards the wall, and all the different sort of level of Jews go down there. I based that entirely on length of beard and size of hat.
Oh, I see.
And we went there, and it is an amazing atmosphere. But our friend Jamie, who was with us, he refused to partake in any of the ceremonies, which I thoroughly admired.
Okay. I love that you've gone, yeah, I'll go to Israel for the holiday, but I'm not going to engage in the religious stuff.
Yes, you've absolutely nailed his outlook on life. And so, but Aaron was like, right, I'm going to get him involved in this. So he made him sort of like the centrepiece of the service by the wall. But Jamie refused to partake in it. And then once you've done the evening service on a Friday night, everyone just is meant to start dancing. And Israeli dancing is very much sort of like arms around the shoulders, dancing round in circles. But what happened then was, because Jamie refused to engage with that, we basically ended up dancing around him. So it was a real golden calf moment.
Nice. You're a maypole.
Yes.
Ribbons to him, wrap him up.
He would have loved that.
Yeah.
Our guest this week is a writer and stand-up comedian. He first appeared on the comedy scene as part of the sketch group The Expeditionary Force, whose first show was a sellout called The First Supper. Great name.
There aren't enough sketch groups named after doomed British war expeditions, is there?
He first gained my attention as the regular host of the brilliant History's Greatest Monster, historically inspired comedy night, and performs stand-up all around the country at clubs including The Stand and The Comedy Store. He is now a gun for hire for the BBC as a writer on The News Jack, The News Quiz, The Now Show, and presumably other shows that don't rely on current affairs. He is the excellently erudite and historically significant Mike Shepherd.
Hello.
Hello. Where would you be without the news?
Yeah, if it's got news in the title, I am probably writing it.
That seems like a good rule of thumb.
But I'm still reeling from the walnut whip joke, so...
Thanks. I have to say, by the way, I think my penzance joke went a little bit underappreciated, by the way. And I'm hoping it got better reaction at home in some people's ears.
I think if you have to do your own post-match analysis on a joke, it's probably not that good.
I'm going to carry this with me.
No, someone will be at home listening to into that. Chopping onions. They've lost a finger now.
Yeah. That's fine. I like to think of that as the Google whack. There's got to be one person somewhere who dies laughing at something.
I think sort of like a 1% hit rate is really what comedy writers are after. What do you look for then when you're writing a comedy sketch? Is there any, or particularly off the news, if you're trying to write current affairs jokes, is there anything that is a regular Mike Shepherd staple?
I really enjoyed writing for Miles Jupp on the news quiz. And the thing about Miles is he tended to go for like either very punchy, sometimes quite sharp gags, mm-hmm. or a really long sort of flight of fancy. And I'd loved writing a long sort of flight of fancy gag for Miles Jupp, where you like you can just leave the news story behind.
Yes.
Imagine this fantasy life where he's sort of parked in a lay-by by a travel lodge on the M11 or something like that. And just sort of building a random fantasy life.
I like that Miles Jupp is so posh that being parked in a lay-by so far away from his reality. So then your love of history comes from, it's basically the news but in the past.
Yeah. I mean, this is, it's like Game of Thrones, but it actually fucking happened. Yeah. Sorry, I've sworn on a podcast.
Oh, absolutely. You're fine. More than welcome to do so. And I've got to ask you, because I asked Barry this, have you ever been on a pilgrimage?
I've been to some sites of pilgrimage. So Rochester in Kent.
It's got a lovely castle, obviously. Rochester.
Yeah, it has. Mm. It was subject to quite a meaty siege, which was completely erroneously depicted in the awful film Iron Clan.
and it's got a really weird Swiss alpine cottage. I think Dickens wrote in it. I might be misremembering that.
Charles Dickens, yeah, it's a big Dickens connection in Rochester. I think Bleak House is an actual, which is a weird one, isn't it? Where you kind of like, oh, our claim to fame is we're the home of Bleak House.
Well, there is Dickens World is there, which is also a place where there used to be a stand-up comedy gig, like a real roughhouse sort of jongler style gig. But apparently you do it and you're just surrounded by strange Dickens animatronics, which is very easy to mistake for the locals. Now, before we crack on, we always ask our guests what they are worst at in the world. What are you truly awful at?
I've been thinking about this, and I suppose have a lot of people said this. Everything. If I can narrow that down,
you're our first guest to claim everything.
Anything that that requires any level of physical coordination or skill.
Excellent.
Or aptitude or remembering of rules. Or I'm bad at games. I can't drive. I'm a 35 year old man who cannot drive a car.
I can't drive.
Which is fine in London.
Yeah.
Guys.
Yeah.
But obviously, you know, back home means I'm an imbecile.
How are you on riding bikes?
I passed my cycling proficiency at 11, but
I was wondering if I could pit you against Ben in some really funny tour of the North London, because Ben can't ride bikes either.
Well, I mean, the last time I rode a bike, I once cycled when I lived in East London. I cycled from the Chelsea Theatre back to my flat in East London, and I had a few ales, and I remember, like, I thought I was being, and I cycled all the way around Hyde Park Corner, straight through the centre of town, and I was really going at it, sort of, you know, my tweed jacket and cravat were flying, and I was sort of determined to get home because I thought I was being chased by the police. And it turns out it was just the flashing light on the front of the bike. In that state as well, I'd like, how did I think I was out cycling them?
Ben,
yes.
You're going to lead us off on our devotional journey.
I, first of all, looked at some of the most inaccessible pilgrimage sites.
Very good.
There's a place in sort of, in and around the sort of Tibet-Nepal-India nexus called Uttarakhand, and that seems to be sort of Hindu Shrine Central. And there are shrines there anywhere between 3,500 meters and 6,500 meters, which you've got to be a pretty hardy person to get there.
Up in the Himalayas.
No? Yeah, up in the Himalayas. But I
I think your god doesn't want to be worshipped if you need a Sherpa to get to their place of worship.
Yeah, that's essentially God putting his out of office on.
Yeah.
Was it normally, because sites of pilgrimage were like originally for in Christianity at least, so it was a way of sort of removing power from pagan sites. So you want it to be accessible, because the Christian church found that they couldn't get people to stop visiting sort of, you know, the temple of Zeus or whatever. So, and obviously like all the holidays that are associated with it. If things are fun, which is why we have, you know, Christmas.
Yeah.
Is like Christmas is that traditional ancient winter festival that people have always celebrated in Europe, and, you know, and around the world there are various versions of it. You can't go, we don't have that anymore because we're Christian. So they said, well done, it's Jesus' birthday. Carry on. you can't beat any joy in. So if you couldn't stop people going to a pagan shrine, you'd get a saint's bones, pop them there and go, well done, it's the shrine of St. Stephen. Yeah. And like, we win. That's why you're going there. Yeah, people are just sort of... But inaccessible doesn't make any sense. I mean, I suppose you want it to be a bit tough, don't you?
So solidly like sticking to there. No, this is where we put it, and this is where it's staying. We're not going to go mainstream. We're staying indie. Hindi.
So sorry.
My
God. There's a particular
another finger gone.
Yeah. There's a particular pilgrimage to Lhasa, which Tibetans do full body prostrations for the entire length of the journey.
They're moving along like caterpillars.
Pretty much, yeah. And then at the end, they become a beautiful butterfly.
How long is this journey?
That I couldn't find out, but, you know, several tens of kilometres.
Okay, fine.
The first place we're going to go to is Ireland, and this one's quite sweet. So this is a pilgrimage to a tiny island off the coast of Connemara's Carna Bay, and it's to pay homage to a local saint, St. MacDara. So he is the patron saint of large, bald comedians and fast food. he was a 6th century hermit saint.
I love hermit saints.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, God, leave me alone. No, we're flocking to you.
I've got a lot of time for Simeon Stylites.
Friend of the show, Simeon Stylites.
On a wheel, on a stick, or up a column. You know, why
not? Get increasingly taller columns to try and keep himself from the crowds. Yeah,
yeah.
But the thing is, I mean, that 6th century is important there, because I think that era, it seemed like you could become a saint for not much.
It was like stand-up comedy in the 90s.
Yeah. Oh, that's it. I went to a Catholic school, and the your classes, we were all named after local Catholic saints.
Yes.
and some of them were like, so there's St. Richard of Chichester, who was like a bishop and was important. There's St. Dunstan, who was Chancellor of England. St. Edmund Campion, who was martyred. Mm.
I went to a Jewish school and all the houses were named after Hollywood producers.
I was in St. Cuthman. And St. Cuthman is most famous for pushing his mum round in a wheelbarrow.
I missed that episode of Last of the Summer Wine. Cuffman's just being transported to Compo as a spelling thing.
St. MacDara, he was a saint who was believed to provide protection to sailors and fishermen and people braving stormy seas. According to one account written by Irish historian Roderick O'Flatt, even, who was alive in the 17th century, he said that what the tradition was is that you had to dip your sails as you went past, and some people even said you had to circle the island three times.
That's a thing that they do a lot as well, walking around shrines or around rocks and things on pilgrimages.
O'Flaherty talks about in 1672, a certain captain of the garrison at Galway neglected to dip his sails and ended up being killed in a shipwreck.
So that's what Jesus would want.
Yes, exactly. There is now an annual festival that is held there, and there's a beautiful picture of online of a little sort of just a little sort of like stone, dry stone house, but it looks very evocative and photogenic.
Oratory, as they're often. My dad's family are from the west coast of Ireland, and there are a lot of the, well, they're not a lot, but it's often like a little hermit's house, and they're sort of like these little dry stone sort of igloos.
I find it so hard with the word hermit not just to think of a green frog. So since the 1970s, crowds have made the journey from the village of Carna on the Mail Island to St. Macdara's Island, either being taken there by nice fishermen or paddling their own wee canoes. Then there's a mass held in honour of his life, and then a picnic. Which is absolutely delightful, but very much not the sort of awfulness that you think of when it comes to pilgrimage.
Yeah, but if they dip their sails, they forget to dip their sails, that's it, they all die on the way back. Doesn't matter how many Marks and Spencer's party eggs you eat for that picnic.
Well, how are you meant to dip your sails in a canoe? You get in the canoe, the canoe goes bang, down to the Davy Jones's locker.
Imagine we made airplanes do like three circuits of an airport before they landed, just for good luck.
Or maybe that's what EasyJet are doing, they say, oh, well, traffic control are not letting us in at the moment. They're like, no, you've got to do it for good luck before you're allowed to.
That's what they do to confuse us into thinking that the world's round.
Yes. So let me just take this colander off my head. But we're now going to go to the other end of the comfort scale. We're staying in your home country. We're going to Donegal.
Are we going to Lough Derg?
We're going to Lough Derg. We're talking about St. Patrick's Purgatory. Yeah. And this is mental. So this has been described as the Iron Man of Christian pilgrimages. It's important that the earliest mention of this comes from medieval texts in 1185. And it's... It's so famous, it is the only Irish site designated on Martin Behaim's world map of 1492. So not Dublin, not Cork, not Limerick, or anywhere like that else. This is the important place. And it's estimated at the moment that the site on Station Island receives about 15,000 visitors a year. Interestingly, since the Celtic Tiger boom at the end of the century, turns out in boom times people want to go on pilgrimages less.
Well, the thing is, now they've got Knock, like, you know, which has got its own airport and a gift shop. I mean, that's your Irish pilgrimage site of choice, isn't it?
Yeah,
Knock's the glamour. That's the Disneyland. That's the Vegas of Catholicism.
Yeah, it's a little bit shiny for me, Knock. But Barry might be able to tell us more about it. But it's basically it's a 3-day pilgrimage. You have to do it without shoes, without socks, and you have to visit, I think it's 9 different stations.
It's all on this island,
All on this island. You're meant to fast for as much of it as possible, certainly the first 24 hours. So when you rest of an evening, you have dry toast and oat cake, or the infamous Lough Derg broth, which is hot water flavoured with salt and pepper.
Delicious. Wow. You want it to be seasoned.
My favourite thing about it is that apparently the people who look after it go out and sharpen the rocks to make sure that you are getting the real suffering in your flesh as you go.
You go to these stations where you have to do 289 prayers at each of them while prostrating and kneeling and bending at various different spots. I've got an account of it from Manchin Magan, who was writing the Irish Times in 2018. He said, I'd first honoured the Blessed Sacrament of the Basilica, then prayed an Our Father, a Hail Mary and a Creed while kneeling at and kissing a pillar. Then, after my renouncement and crucifixion stance, I walked 4 times around the Basilica saying 7 rosaries and another creed. All of this is just an appetizer for the real meat of the station, which involves walking around 6 stony circular tracks. Each of them is known as a penitential bed and is dedicated to a particular saint. I walk clockwise around the outside of each bed 3 times while paying 3 Hail Marys and 3 Our Fathers, followed by a creed. I then kneel on the jagged stones at the entrance to each bed. It's this thing of walking and then kneeling and facing one way and facing the other. But the best thing is, he talks about how all the clambering and grappling you are doing with other pilgrims, all pulling at and wrestling at each other like a game of Twister to find a spot to kneel on the jagged rocks that isn't too tortuous. It's all fighting for the smoothest bits to kneel on.
I read that article and I couldn't work out from the tone of it whether it was isn't this a bit of a weird lark?
Yeah.
Or that it was like, turns out I believe this and I'm doing it, but I can't believe I'm doing it and I believe it. The reason it was picked, historically, St. Patrick's Purgatory was considered as the turnstile to the gates of hell.
Yeah, there's a pit, a hole in the ground.
There was another time when the visitor numbers dipped, which is there was a time when a Dutch monk complained to the Pope that he'd visited there and no demons had attacked him during the visit. Which is a hell of a TripAdvisor review, isn't it?
He mightn't have done the 24-hour vigil. They have to stay awake for 24 hours at one point. It's just great. There's a bit where he talks about the they're in the basilica sort of nudging people back awake again.
There's nothing like a bit of sleep deprivation to kind of guarantee that you will.
Yeah. You'll see Christ, yeah.
Oh, God, it sounds horrible.
Yeah.
Horrible.
A lot of people, like Seamus Heaney went on it. Mary McAleese, the former President of Ireland, went
Seamus,
on it.
Seamus Heaney wrote an enormous poetry cycle called Station Island that I will not read.
I mean, it's just, ow.
Yeah.
Ow! 900 pages.
But in meter.
My knees really hurt.
I've got one more thing to tell you about before my suggestion. This is one of our favourite things on this show. I want to tell you about someone called Saborga in Italy, which is a micronation. Bloody love a micronation.
Yes, not a time for a micronation.
So they are, it is the self-proclaimed Principality of Saborga, which claims to be an independent state within itself. So apparently in 1729, Saborga and the 14 square kilometres around it were supposedly bought by the Kingdom of Sardinia, which later became part of Italy. However, apparently the sales contract was never officially signed, stamped and paid for, so it's not valid. The reason why Saborga is home to secular pilgrims is because there is a fictional anime character called Saborga, who sounds like a bit of a prick. He's apparently a womanizer.
I read about this. It's an anime manga series where the characters are all personifications of countries.
Oh, really?
So, like, there's the Italy brothers and things like that, and they're all, like, based on whatever stereotype they view of these countries. So, yeah, in their view, Saborga is a womanizer and passive, I think, is another way he's described in it.
Yeah, so I love the fact that there are loads of sort of Japanese nerds wandering to this tiny little bit principality in Italy to go on an underwhelming pilgrimage, and a pilgrimage that's got nothing to do with the culture and history of the place. It's like, yep, this is the name of the place.
To find Russell Brand's spiritual home.
Yeah. But I looked for the most sort of underwhelming slash bizarre place for a pilgrimage, and it is barely 50 miles from here. We're going to East Sussex.
Yes.
Because,
this is so good.
Yeah. I don't know if you know about this, but East Grinstead, a small town in
Scientology.
East Sussex.
Yeah.
Scientology. Well, not just Scientology.
It turns out.
Fucking everything. It is jam-packed full of so many different religious headquarters.
For non-British people, you want to describe East Grinstead.
So East Grinstead is a small little market town. If you have an image in your head of provincial England, this is it.
Yeah.
It is small C conservative. It is old reverends wandering around on their bicycles with a wicker basket at the front. It's long shadows on cricket pitches. I'm turning into John Major.
Yeah,
it's got a lovely steam railway.
There you are. Yeah, it's if you're into it, like Midsummer Murders is somewhere that could be set there. Amongst other things, they've got old wooden buildings that used to be occupied by the Rosicrucians, who were
we chatted about them recently. They're mystical Christianity.
Yeah.
Into sort of self-pain and things like that.
Dan Brown's favourite, aren't they?
Yeah. Talking of Dan Brown, Opus Dei are also there. Christian Scientists, who I frankly refuse to give any time of day to because they're a living oxymoron. The Dowsing Society, the Pagan Federation are there. The Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints have got a building in the area, but Mormons are fucking everywhere. The Anthroposophical Society, who are the people who Rudolf Steiner was at the heart of. Steiner schools, of course, if you want to send your 7-year-old to school to speak in Greek and play the tambourine in a non-cornered room for hours on end. There's also loads and loads of different churches. I don't think there's a synagogue there, which I take great offence to, but as you say, it is the home of Scientology. L. Ron Hubbard, who's the founder of Scientology, bought a mansion there in 1959. He bought it from the Maharaja of Jaipur after they met in a casino in London, and the Maharaja said he needed to settle his gambling debts. Yeah. So
there's something really unromantic about the Maharaja of Jaipur living in East Grinstead, isn't there?
Yeah. So Hubbard gave him 58 grand. He turned it into Saints Hill Castle. That sort of looks a little bit like a mock Norman castle now, adjacent to the main manor. The really weird thing, which I'm sure is what you read about, is that recently Tom Cruise invested in renovations of there, totaling $60 million. Mm. He ingratiated himself to the local community. He donated $10,000 to the local rugby team, which is very sweet of him. And he is contemplating moving there, apparently.
Did he rename them the East Grenster to Thetans?
Did he?
No.
That would be incredible. The East Grinstead Tory councillor, Dick Sweatman, signed a drug-free pledge on the High Street, which is in collaboration with the Church of Scientology, who are do have an irritatingly good record at getting people off drugs, but I think it's substituting one addiction for another.
Yeah.
East Grinstead has apparently become a bit of a site of pilgrimage for Scientologists from all over the world, because it's where their founder lived for an awful lot of time.
Didn't he have the idea? Yeah, it was only shortly after he'd written that article saying, if you want to make money, you should start a religion.
Yes.
But it's completely unrelated.
Yeah, completely unrelated, distinct.
I mean, this isn't a pilgrimage now, but what I would like to proffer, what I'd like to put forward, certainly as one of the just worst ideas in history, is the Children's Crusade.
Excellent.
Of 1212, which we think, I think on balance, did definitely happen. It's reported in enough sources. Something like this definitely went on and involved up to tens of thousands of people. It sort of is at a point in history where obviously, like, we remember the classic crusades, the First Crusade, the Second Crusade, Third Crusade. Mm. So this is kind of like like the unnumbered Star Wars films.
Yes.
Yeah, like it's like a little spin-off. So obviously we think of crusades and we think of knights in armour going off to reclaim the Holy Land, claim the Holy Land. claim the Holy Land for Christianity. And so there've been a number of crusades, appeals by the Pope for Christians to come and take back control.
Yeah. whenever a pope was short of a bit of cash, feeling a bit politically insecure.
It's an interesting movement because it kind of shows the dangers of populism and even the medieval world. Because crusades weren't just to the Holy Land. I mean, there were Baltic crusades as well. So again, talking about things that are hard to do or hard to get to for loads of people in England and northern France and Germany. Going all the way to Jerusalem is really tough.
Yeah.
So sometimes they go, well, why don't we just go to Lithuania and kill them? Because the other, because this is there were some very interesting developments in theology at the time. So it had previously been for most of Christianity's history up to sort of this point up to the 12th century, people had thought that pagans could be, you could try and convert them, but mainly you could leave them alone and let them do their own thing. And then the theory kind of becomes current that it is your duty as a Christian to convert people who aren't Christian, and if they don't want to be converted, it is fine to kill them.
Yeah.
You know, like Jesus would do.
Yeah. Well, I love the way that Jesus can be a blank canvas for so many different things. So just before the Crusades, you have Anglo-Saxon stories of Jesus, of basically the warrior Jesus.
Yeah.
And there's a story called The Harrowing of Hell, where Jesus puts on his armour, goes down into hell, and kicks ass like Captain America.
Jesus is much like Barbie in that he's been reinvented time after time with different jobs and roles to suit the current era. We have our idea of what the Crusades are. What is the Children's Crusade?
So the Children's Crusade, on paper, doesn't it seem nicer than a crusade of sort of men in chainmail going and killing people. But it's also a stupid idea, isn't it? So it was that there were two kind of charismatic, there's a pair of charismatic shepherd boys. So many of my stories start this way.
One in Germany and one in France, isn't there?
So there's a guy called Stephen of Cloyes in France and Nicholas of Cologne in Germany. And they are enigmatic young shepherd boys who kind of gather people to them and gather an army of children, with the idea being that children are our future.
Yeah, they're the Greta Thunbergs of
their day. This is why I think it is I think it has a nice resonance now.
She didn't tell them that the Mediterranean would part. Yeah. She said the Mediterranean would dry up.
So the idea is an army of children will go to Jerusalem, because Jerusalem had fallen to Saladin in 1187. So in 1212, The idea is they will go and reclaim Jerusalem, but not by force of arms, not by killing people. The kind of the purity and the innocence of the children, they'll turn up in the Holy Land, and everybody there will immediately convert to Catholicism.
Because of lovely children.
Because of, yeah. And, and then
flaws.
And then it will all be fine. Revisionists have sort of tried to say whether were they even children or were they kind of like the dispossessed poor or things like that. I find it quite interesting just because I think we have quite a set idea of medieval Europe sometimes where you think, oh, well, it's feudalism and like peasants do as they're told and there are the lords and the knights and everyone sort of everything sort of funnels into the king and everyone lives a kind of a very sort of set life. But in fact, There were massive advantages to the Catholic Church in many ways. Like if you became a monk or a nun, you could go off and have quite an academic career and travel the world and
brew beer and have secret orgies while they're
There's quite a lot of flexibility, and I'm kind of drawn to this as a sort of popular. It's a popular proletarian movement, and it shows a kind of a level of flexibility in medieval society. But also, and I can't stress this enough, it's still a really stupid idea. And they don't make it. They don't even make it anywhere near.
There's one I think is the Stevens Group that suggests maybe 30,000 young people reaching Italy and going.
When you think about it, particularly with the population numbers at that time, because one pilgrimage I didn't talk about, but it's a staple of history GCSE, is the Pilgrimage of Grace, which was an enormous protest against Henry VIII. And that's something like 30,000 people. And when you realise there were only about 2 million people in England at the time, that's a lot of the population going, we're quite angry with you, Henry.
Yeah.
So 30,000 people in the 13th century, that's a hell of a conga line.
You've always got to be wary of numbers when they turn up in historic sources, because often they're just there for emphasis. I mean, there's the old tradition, like the people always said, oh, isn't it funny how these exactly the same number of people died in the plague of Constantinople as died in the plague of Athens? And it's just because Procopius, wanting to tell his readers that it was a really bad plague, picked the same number from Thucydides.
It was a lot.
And, just basically meaning loads, mate.
Yeah.
But, it seems to have happened because they went round bothering people. So Stephen of Cloyes' group tries to get a meeting with the King of France, who is not interested. this is the thing that interests me. So you've got a kind of like an adolescent shepherd boy who can obviously whip people up and win people round. He claims to have a letter from Jesus. which again is like, it's the Jeremy Corbyn sort of Question Time defence, isn't it? I've got a letter here from Jesus.
Next up, a fax from Muhammad.
Yeah.
I don't think a nice Jewish boy like Jesus is going to be sending letters to Jeremy Corbyn.
No. I'm kind of fascinated to know like what a potentially semi-literate teenage farm worker who either doesn't have a letter from Jesus or has made a letter. What does that look like?
He's cut out letters out of illuminated manuscripts and pasted them like a ransom note. Go to Genoa or.
You spelled Jesus with a Z? They get as far as Marseille and end up sort of begging. The German group go through, split into two, and go through Switzerland and
yeah, they cross the Alps.
They cross the this is the kind of like the charismatic sort of fervour.
Yeah,
hundreds of years later, Joan of Arc will have the same sort of effect. I think it's interesting that people could be in what we think of as a sort of very stratified society. People were willing to go. All right.
Yeah.
I like what the kid says. I'm going with it. things didn't work out so well for Nicholas of Cologne and like his dad. So his dad stays behind and is then prosecuted and hanged, but basically because his son has run off with all the children.
Like all the parents of these kids have disappeared.
I mean, it's a tricky PTA meeting to have, isn't it?
Yeah.
I like the fact that they got to Genoa, I think, that group, and he said, well, we get to Genoa and then the sea will part and we'll walk across the Mediterranean to the Holy Land, and obviously that did not happen.
Yeah. It's a plan, isn't it? It's
It sounds like Moses of Crete.
But then the Genoese offered citizenship to all of them, which is really lovely. It's really nice. He went on to Pisa, I think. He just kept bothering people and then tried to go to Rome and was like, I want to see the Pope.
That's
the Pope
right,
was like, no. Basically, they were like, oh, there's a crusade. Excellent. Who's leading it? A child? Absolutely not. Obviously, in charge.
It's odd, isn't it, when you think how in a way that, like, already there's a status quo, and people don't like anything to be rocked. So, like, the Pope and the King of France, and we kind of imagine that when people say miracles are happening and things have, you know, people have been, we imagine that medieval people tend to sort of believe each other. But, like, why do you believe this miracle and not that one? Why do you believe this charismatic and not the other?
Yeah. Do you know, I know Nicholas Colon on his way back, he died trying to cross the Alps, going back again.
Well, I mean, some of them might have made it. We don't know. There's no record. So some of them go as far as southern Italy to Bari.
Oh, yes.
I think, and they're trying to get on a ship. And at that point, they sort of disappear from the
there's a lot of awkward sort of bits that I've read about. Oh, they get on ships and they'd end up in, like, Tripoli or in the Barbary slave trade and stuff like that. Welcome to the Holy Land. You work for this guy.
Yeah, the self-trafficking.
Yes.
Yeah.
But yeah, self-trafficking children
is an amazing phrase.
My good God.
But is it, I sort of imagine that maybe if some of them did get to the Holy Land or whatever, it would be like a sort of Monty Python cutaway scene. Of
yes.
Like, there's this sort of these years, you know, the months and years of toil, and eventually they get there and immediately are cut down by the by the incumbent Saracens.
Yeah, that's true. I read a bit about the world's longest, as in terms of ground covered, pilgrimage. Do you want to have a guess at how long, at how far this dude has walked around the world?
Is this, is this getting into the thing of, like, going, oh, you got to go around it three times?
But that's a very good point. He hasn't quite made it that far yet. He has covered 69,202 kilometres, which is the Earth once and a half times, or a bit more than once and a half.
What is he running from?
This is a guy, and I'm not making this up, a guy called Arthur Blessett. As of July 2019, he claims to have covered, as I say, 43,000 miles. He holds the Guinness World Record for a round-the-world pilgrimage. He's been on a walking mission since the 25th of December, Christmas Day, 1969. During this time, he has visited all seven continents, including Antarctica. He has crossed 321 nations, islands, groups, and territories, carrying a 12-foot wooden cross and preaching the Bible on his
way. Oh, my God!
Yeah. He was born in Mississippi, grew up in Louisiana, and his father managed a cotton farm at the age of seven.
Oh, that explains it then.
Yeah, at the age of seven, he became a Christian. And he studied at a seminary, abandoned it to serve as a pastor in different churches, and then he ended up in California, in Hollywood, in the 60s, and was a bit of a hippie. Became known as the Minister of the Sunset Strip. In March 1968, he opened a coffee house called His Place at a building next to a topless go-go bar. And he made the cross to hang on the wall in the building, and he started carrying it up and down the strip while he was evangelising.
It's like when you get a photo framed and you're not quite sure where to put it, and then you...
Yeah.
Does it look better over the fireplace or by the door? I'll just walk around the world.
My favourite thing is that he went to New York and opened up a sort of a version of His Place in New York. Again, he was sort of near the Times Square area, so he was competing with all the topless entertainment that was around. So his version of His Place in New York had a peephole and was advertised by a marquee with the announcement, totally naked. And if you peeped through the peephole, all you would see was a mirror captioned with the words, man stands naked before his God.
I mean, I think most people would probably try and beat off to that.
Yeah.
You'd give it a go, wouldn't you?
He said... of his inspiration for us, he heard the voice of Jesus calling him to walk to every nation, and he made his first overseas crosswalk in 1971 to Northern Ireland, and as I say, he's carried it to every nation. During the Cold War, he went to the Soviet Union, through the Baltic States, the Ukraine. He's been to Iraq and North Korea and Iran and Afghanistan, Palestine, Israel, Cuba, and in 2008 he made it to Zanzibar, completing his goal to make every country.
It seems like he brings trouble. Like, hang on, 1971 he goes to Northern Ireland. Just chaos is just following this guy.
He's been arrested 24 times. He's met world leaders including George Bush, Pope John Paul II, Yasser Arafat and Muammar Gaddafi, and has lost his cross twice. It's a 12-foot tall. I have no idea.
I suppose at certain places you've got to check it into the cloakroom.
Yeah.
And then, you know, there's just hundreds of 12-foot crosses.
Yeah. You never know which one is yours.
EasyJet aren't going to deal with that, are they?
Yeah.
Paying through the nose.
And in 1970 1976, he made a bid for the Democratic nomination for president. The nomination was won by Jimmy Carter. He withdrew after contesting the New Hampshire and Florida primaries, polling fifth in Florida with 8,171 votes. He stated he was a happy loser because spiritual and moral reform has become a major campaign issue now.
I know, it seems like it seems like he'd be a good politician, because if you think that voting campaign, isn't it? It's like you, like, oh, what do I do again? Oh yeah, cross in the box.
Yeah. And he's not afraid to, you know, pound the pavements, get out there, knocking a few doors. Then it made me look at long pilgrimage walks, and I found a Buddhist walk on the island of Shikoku in Japan, which is 1,200 kilometres long. There's 88 temples associated with the Buddhist monk Kukai on this island, and basically pilgrims walk to all of them, and this island is split up into four provinces, and the journey through the four provinces is likened to the symbolic path to enlightenment. So temples 1 to 23 represent awakening, and then 24 to 39 are austerity and discipline, 40 to 65 are attaining enlightenment, and 66 to 88 entering nirvana.
89 is wild card.
Yeah.
Where this week it's Hawaii. Yeah.
And the Camino is the really famous pilgrimage that a lot of people...
To Compostela.
Yes, to Santiago. So it's basically... The Camino is... It's a large network of different pilgrim routes. All across Europe you can make... You end up in Santiago de Compostela in northwest Spain, which is where apparently the tomb of St. James is. And so people would make the way and to it from all across Europe. The most popular route, which people do nowadays still, is the Camino Frances, which starts near Biarritz and goes all the way there. Basically, if you imagine, there's loads of like little streams joining tributaries, joining the main river. So eventually, everyone ends up on this one final
road. So all roads don't lead to Rome.
Yeah, they lead to Santiago de Compostela. Yeah, it's Croagh Patrick, it means St. Patrick's Stack, is a 764-metre tall mountain. It's barely a mountain, but quite a tall hill in the west of Ireland. And particularly on the last July, the last Sunday in July, Reek Sunday, thousands of pilgrims climb it and have a mass on the summit. And this is one of the places where they do these rounding rituals, where they just walk either clockwise around the mountain before going up it, or they walk three times around large rocks that are on the route on the way up. So you were just trying to get to the top, and there are people doing these little circuits along the way.
Someone, yeah, just sort of wandering, like, oh no, he's gone again.
Yeah. like one of those wind-up toys, occasionally you need to pick him up and point the right direction again. There's a lovely place in St. Johnsbury, Vermont, where you can go on a pilgrimage to.
Is it Ben and Jerry's factory?
No, it's not. There's a place called Dog Mountain, 150-acre mountaintop expanse with ponds, fields and trails. It's there's a lovely... Basically, the grounds are open for dog walkers to enjoy it leash-free. And on the grounds of this place, there is a chapel.
Is it? And that's a shrine to St. Bernard? Only one finger left now, guys.
you will be delighted to hear it is a chapel to dogs. There are stained glass windows of dogs being petted by human hands, licking scoops of ice cream.
Are we sure it hasn't just been built by a dyslexic? There goes the last finger.
It's the thumbnail.
Get yourself to hospital,
The edges of the pews are carved into the shapes of sitting dogs. And there's a doorknob with the dog's head with the symbol with the words "all creatures welcome." There's a doggy door as well as a human door into the chapel. This dog chapel was built by Stephen Hunek. It was an artist and children's author, and his wife Gwen, to celebrate the bond between dogs and mankind.
And what does the priest there wear?
A big hat. He referred to it as the largest artwork of his life and his most personal. This guy Hunek wrote 10 books about a Labrador dog called Sally, and inside the chapel there's a statue to a winged Sally on a pedestal, and the people come and they post little post-it notes on the walls and photos of their dead dogs and notes from their owners and things like "Dukey, we miss you sneezing on us when we rub your belly," etc, etc. I mean, it's a bit sickly. It's not as creepy as this place in Japan, and you know, we have to do at least one or two Japanese references on this show. There is a Japanese belief that if you don't get rid of a doll properly, its soul will stick around and curse you and bring bad luck and stuff, and so there is a shrine where you can bring your dolls to get rid of them. It's a, basically a giant temple full of unwanted dolls. The majority of them at this place.
And if you can spend one night there, you win $1 million.
The majority of the ones in this place are Hina Ningyo, which are traditional dolls that are given on Girls' Day, which I didn't know is it's a festival on March the 3rd every year, dating back to the 1600s, where you would pray for the health and happiness of your family's daughters. And so one of the things you traditionally do, apparently, is give them these dolls. They would bring good luck and take the bad luck onto themselves. It has now become the tradition to give them away to this temple, Awashima Jinja. And every year on Girls' Day, they dispose of the dolls in a festival called Nagashi Bina, where boatloads of these dolls are launched out into the ocean.
What? So it's like a sort of sin-eating ritual.
Yeah, the waves consume them and the dolls are sunk to the bottom of the ocean, so they'll take away the sickness and bad luck from their owners.
Hang on, but these dolls are probably made of single-use plastic. So yeah. Instead, this Japanese cult is, or tradition, is killing hundreds of turtles.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's it. There's a Barbie plugged into a like blue whale's blowhole.
So then
it dies. That's the bad luck.
Yeah.
So the system works.
Yeah. You get rid of the bad luck brought on by the dolls, but then you're haunted by a family of sturgeons for the rest of your life. Israel has a bit of a problem. Jerusalem has a bit of a problem with a syndrome.
Yeah, we heard about that. Yeah.
Called. All that aside, it has a thing called Jerusalem syndrome. Have you heard of Paris syndrome?
I have, but I can't remember what it is.
It's basically this condition where people who go to visit Paris on holiday are shocked that it doesn't look like what they imagine it to be. That it's like, it's dirty. It's a city, rather than the romantic, beautiful Monet painting they think they're visiting. And it has symptoms like delusions and hallucinations, feelings of persecution, depersonalization, anxiety, and various psychosomatic manifestations. And there's another syndrome, a bit like it, called Stendhal syndrome, where the French author Stendhal visited the Basilica of Santa Croce in Florence, where Machiavelli and Galileo and Michelangelo are all buried. And he was overcome by weird ecstasy at just how overwhelmingly beautiful and significant the place was. Well, Jerusalem syndrome, you can probably imagine, it's people just get overwhelmed by religious rapture in visiting Jerusalem. And I did like this article I read about it, commented, if you talk to God, it's regarded as a prayer, but if a God talks to you, you're bonkers. The Jerusalem Post reported a British tourist who vanished in the desert and apparently left scraps of paper with New Testament passages along his route pinned down by rocks, and he just disappeared. There's another story about an Austrian chef walking into a hotel demanding to be taken to the kitchen so he could prepare a last supper. There was an American who was convinced he was Samson and tried to attack the Western Wall to tear it down. Some people make their bed sheets into togas, some people refuse to wash themselves, people flailing themselves, and there's obviously lots of people crying out in street corners proclaiming their own personal revelations. There's increasing numbers of people experience it since the 80s, apparently between 50 and 100 times a year. There's a caveat to this. There's about 80% of people diagnosed with Jerusalem syndrome have an existing or previous medical condition, and the remainder are generally tourists who undergo a psychotic episode within the city. There's very few of them who it's just a spontaneous something.
Yeah, it's not Jerusalem's fault.
Yeah, exactly. And the point is, it's not that some people are sort of a bit wary of calling it Jerusalem
syndrome.
It's
the same thing, isn't it, of going on the pilgrimage and depriving yourself of sleep for 24 hours.
Yeah.
If you've gone somewhere, and again, it's Jerusalem, it's hot, you might be dehydrated. Yeah. Again, takes me back to the Children's Crusade again, because I'm fascinated by like mass hysteria events and things like that, especially when it happens as sort of to a number of people sort of fixate on something, like the 1518 dancing plague of Strasbourg is absolutely my favourite but terrible historical event, when people just started dancing and then they danced for days and days and more people joined them and they all started dancing and then they died.
Well, it's, I think that goes back to an early version of the of avian flu known as the birdie song.
It was the origin of Dance Dance Revolution, I think we can all agree. Simon Rigo, director of psychology training at Albert Einstein College of Medicine / Montefiore Medical Center in New York City, said, you see things like this emerge periodically in the literature where people think they have found a unique syndrome, but it may just be the result of an underlying mental illness. He says historical factors, including culture and context, can influence the way delusions are experienced. And for example, after the Truman Show came out, 1998, psychiatrists in Montreal started reporting cases of patients with Truman Show delusion because they were convinced they were the subjects of a secret reality show as well.
Thanks to t-shirts you can buy, I went to Jerusalem and all I got was this lousy syndrome.
But I'm going to go to the medieval pilgrimages for my choice.
Great.
I read a bit about medieval pilgrims in general. Catholic, do you know they wear like little badges to show they've been on pilgrimages?
The scallop shell is Compostela, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like getting your wristband going to Glastonbury or whatever festival you've been to. Apparently, you could get erotic badges with male walking phalluses and crowned vulvas and things like that.
The crowned vulva. I'm sure I've drunk that.
So they'd satirise normal pilgrim badges by, like, showing vulvas walking hand in hands on a pilgrimage.
The Vulva Pilgrims is an excellent punk band.
Yeah. Some people aren't entirely sure of the origins of it. It seems like they're definitely a satire. They were sold at carnivals and fairs, maybe. Or they would indicate the sexual freedom of the pilgrims. And this is a big deal, that people were... genuinely saw pilgrimages as corrupting influences.
Well, yes, because you're outside of the norms. I mean, again, in an age when it was actually quite difficult to leave the manor or the town where you lived. Like, I mean, living in a town gave you certain freedom, but then you couldn't just go where you liked. It's in the Canterbury Tales, isn't it? It's the party of a lifetime.
Yeah, exactly.
To be on a pilgrimage.
The 8th century Pope St. Boniface complained that female pilgrims travelling to Rome were falling into prostitution on their way. And a medieval proverb warned, "Go a pilgrim, return a whore." I've come to return this whore.
It's
slightly cracked. Apparently, also, churches along pilgrimage routes would have exhibitionist male and female figures with like enlarged genitalia to remind people about the possibility of lust and sin along the way, which I would imagine only encouraged them.
That's put me off that. Giant cock and balls.
I want you to stop wanking, and by doing that I'm going to show you this porn. There were people who would grab like souvenirs from their pilgrimage, like people chipping a little bit out of the Berlin Wall. Some people took it a bit far. So Hugh of Lincoln apparently visited the French monastery of Fécamp and chewed off a piece of what was said to be Mary Magdalene's arm.
Was St. Hugh a dog?
You could also get someone to be sent on a pilgrimage as a punishment. If they committed murder, they'd often hang the murder weapon around their neck to show that what they had done, like branding someone.
There is a faulty logic, isn't there, of when somebody has killed someone and then you send them off to another town
armed,
returning
sometimes they'd be forced to carry it out barefoot or naked. And I love this bit. It's like when you'd be sent to the office to get to do a message in school, you'd have to get a signature at the shrine along the way to bring it back. So you'd be
great.
And you could send people on vicarious pilgrimages. If you were too ill, sick, or lazy to go on a pilgrimage, you could just pay someone to do it for you.
Right. Well, I was thinking about this as well, because you could do the labyrinth pattern.
Yes.
So in cathedrals, and there's one in Chartres, there's a labyrinth in the sort of etched in stone in the floor, and that was for people who couldn't go physically to Jerusalem, but you could... walk the labyrinth.
We're honing in on my suggestion. Yeah. These vicarious pilgrimages, for example, a Norwich baker's wife couldn't walk because of how swollen her feet was, and so her husband visited the shrine of St. William on her behalf. Isabel of Bavaria, she was so worried about her health, she sent loads of pilgrims like everywhere, to basically every sacred shrine she could find in France. One pilgrim was sent to Notre Dame du Blanc Mesnil with a 15-pound candle, and they were to pray there for 15 days, burning a pound of wax every day for her. But you mentioned the labyrinth and these people who couldn't go to Jerusalem, and obviously we had these warnings of pilgrimages being corrupting. Bernard of Clairvaux said that it was dangerous and it was a big undertaking. You could be ill. It's very expensive. And so a variety of pilgrimage texts became available to the public. One of them was produced in Oxford in the 1420s and basically allowed people to read their way through a Roman Jubilee pilgrimage.
So they got you had to choose your
you
own
had
adventure.
To choose your own adventure pilgrimage. So describe the physical journey and say all the meditations you do. You'd say 10 paternosters a day, one for each league you would have walked if you'd been walking it. And after you reach the city, you'd then dedicate 7 days to meditation on the 7 principal churches of Rome. And then after spending about 15 weeks altogether on this spiritual pilgrimage, you'd then pray yourself back home again. And this isn't an isolated thing. The Canterbury Tales is a text that you can read your way through. Piers Plowman is another one. Felix Fabry, in the 1480s, he accounted his pilgrimages to the Holy Land, and his day-by-day accounts would be read by enclosed nuns who weren't allowed to leave their community, so they could make an imaginary pilgrimage to Jerusalem. But my favourite one is...
Well, where have you gone on your holidays? Oh, I went to imaginary Rome.
Yeah.
Go there every year, yeah. It's lovely this time.
It's too many imaginary tourists now. Yeah. It's being imaginary
it's been
room
spoiled
now, yeah.
It's been imaginary room. I don't know why I do it to myself. It's a shithole these days.
Keep flying on imaginary Ryanair. I'm an idiot. But my favourite one of these was Matthew Paris's Chronica Majora. He wrote the 7-page codex to this. He was a 13th century Benedictine monk.
Good.
And he had...
Good. Not the
not
former
Matthew
Tory
Paris.
Politician.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah,
Paris.
Writer for the Times. No.
But
he's one of the sources for the Children's Crusade as well.
Yes, yeah, he's quite a good one. But his Choose Your Own Adventure is really evocative. It's only 7 pages, but it has maps from London to Rome and Jerusalem with flaps you could flip up and down to sort of
like
pick your
kid's book.
Your route. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So our candidates today for the world's worst pilgrimages are Ben's suggestion of Saint Hill Manor, the beacon of Scientology in lush East Grinstead in Sussex. Mike's suggestion of the doomed Children's Crusade, who really met with serious resistance to that. They were a bit ahead of their time.
Yeah.
My suggestion of the imaginary pilgrimages carried out by medieval readers of the likes of Matthew Paris. I am a big fan of anything that brings down Scientology. And East Grinstead is so mundane. It's wonderful in that respect. The Children's Crusade I had heard of, and it is, if you're reading medieval history, it's one of those things you want to have a chapter on. It's just an interesting stop along the way through all of that religious
and it's
history.
A classic the past is a foreign country thing. You're like, that would health and safety and safe.
Well, we've got the climate school strike, you know. They didn't march into the sea, though.
Are you suggesting that Greta Thunberg is the 21st century version of those Pied Pipers from Cologne?
A lot of people compare it to Joan of Arc.
Yeah.
But let's not forget that Joan of Arc, of course, wasn't that friendly to the environment.
Yeah.
In the end.
She was very much a fossil fuel herself.
Yeah.
But I have to say, I'm a huge fan of My Discovery.
It's brilliant.
The imaginary, I mean, again, it's the sweet spot of this show. I'm reminded of when we did World's Worst Gadget and the No Phone Zero one, which was a block of plastic in the shape of an iPhone, so you just wouldn't, so you could have it in your pocket, so you wouldn't miss having an iPhone in your pocket.
Just like the feeling.
Just the feeling of it there, so it'd give you that sense of security. And similarly, and the fact it's a Choose Your Own Adventure book, which you and I, growing up in the 90s, I imagine definitely both had lots of them. So I'm going to pick Imaginary Pilgrimages.
I dispute this only because, in fact, that's not the worst pilgrimage. That's the best pilgrimage.
It's that thing of being half-arsed.
There is still no feeling in the world better than not having to do a thing.
Yeah.
Than not having to leave the house.
Yeah. I will remind you that it's 15 weeks there and back doing this. Dragging a book out over 30 weeks. it's hardly a page turn. Before we go, I'm going to give you the world's worst news of the week. And this news comes from AmericanMarijuana.org.
I'm listening.
We're looking for... It's a job offer. We're looking for someone to review a wide variety of cannabis products to give our readers an honest and reliable insight on various cannabis products.
I'm still listening.
The applicant will have to write about their honest reviews and opinions of the products in the form of a blog. Moreover, they must also be comfortable in front of the camera, since the job includes unboxing videos and explainer videos of how each cannabis product performs and differs from other more notable products in the category. The ad says that the successful applicant needs to be physically fit and healthy to be able to carry out these cannabis reviews regularly, and whoever gets the gig will be paid up to $3,000 monthly, or $36,000 yearly, depending depending on their experience and their capabilities.
Okay, I am extraordinarily experienced. I've got a good 15 years of smoking in my CV.
Yeah.
Where do I sign?
Well, you can go to marijuana.org, and the applicant must be over 18 and is required to send a bio, a headshot, or preferably a link to a 60-second intro video talking about your passion for the position. There links to your existing social media accounts, and at least 6 street names, slang terms, or nicknames of marijuana, and I quote, so we know you're taking this seriously.
You will have the old pilgrimage dust.
You'll have free cannabis products sent on a monthly basis to your address for testing, including weed strains, vapes, and edibles and CBD oils.
Send me the inspiration cabbage now.
Yeah. I can't imagine anyone who regularly smokes weed limiting their application video to 60 seconds. Yeah. 3 hours long, and we'll sort of detail how the Incas were from outer space.
Ben is genuinely googling the website right now. Before we go, Mike, where can people find out more about you and what you're up to?
So yes, I worked on a series recently that's still on BBC Sounds called The Museum of Curiosity. That was a lot of good fun. I'm on Twitter at Mike Shepherd. I'm on Instagram at Shepherd Mike.
I'm gathering your followers.
A charismatic shepherd. Yeah. Join me, follow me. No, I do not want your children to follow me. I'm in a film called Guardians, which is available through Sky and Virgin Media from the 2nd of December. It is an independently made, relatively low budget comedy, but it is, crucially, I think, quite funny. And it was made by some very nice people, and I'm in it. Called Guardians.
Very good. Meanwhile, we're all off to start recording our imaginary podcast, so we hope you enjoy imaginarily listening to it. That's going to be much less work for us long term.
It will do, yeah, but the ground rent on the studio in Atlantis is really expensive.
Thank you for listening to Worst Foot Forward. Bye.
Worst Foot Forward is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of Worst Foot Forward and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter via @podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.